We would like to send out a special thanks to BetterHelp for supporting The Trail Went Cold. For 10% off your first month, go to betterhelp.com/trail and start living a better life today. Enjoy the show. October 4th, 1978. Lyon County, Iowa. The decomposed body of a murdered young woman is discovered in a ditch next to a rural road, but since she carries no identification, she remains Jane Doe for the next 27 years. The victim is eventually identified as 23-year-old Wilma June Nissen, who originally hailed from California and lived a transient lifestyle prior to her death. Investigators discover that Wilma was involved with an escort service, and two women she worked with may have been responsible for her murder, but there is not enough evidence to charge anyone with the crime. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a cold case about a victim who was an unidentified Jane Doe for over two decades, the 1978 murder of Wilma June Nissen. This episode is a pretty important one because Wilma's daughter, Chrissy Haas Atkinson, contacted me and personally requested that I covered her story. Even though Chrissy was just an infant at the time Wilma was murdered, and she never got the chance to meet her mother, she is still seeking justice for what happened. Wilma lived an incredibly difficult life before she was murdered and dumped in a ditch in rural Iowa, but since she was never officially reported missing, it would be over 27 years before law enforcement was able to determine her identity. Investigators have since determined that Wilma had been working for an escort service in South Dakota and may have been murdered after traveling across the state line to attend a party. Two women who worked alongside Wilma are now considered to be possible suspects, but while investigators have managed to track one of them down, they do not know the exact identity of the second woman or her current whereabouts. At the moment, the police lack sufficient evidence to charge anyone with Wilma's murder, but if the right person were to come forward with information, that could lead to a major break in the case. So on this episode, we're going to detail Wilma's tragic backstory, as well as spread awareness about the horrific crime which ended her life. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unsolved murder of Wilma June Nissen. Our story begins in 1978 in Lyon County, Iowa. On the morning of October the 4th, a phone company employee was laying some cable in a rural area alongside Highway 182 when they stumbled across the decomposing body of a female. The victim had been dumped in a ditch next to an adjacent gravel road, and her body was concealed by some weeds. The Lyon County Sheriff's Office was summoned to the scene and discovered that the level of decomposition on the victim's face had made her unrecognizable. The woman was nude from the waist up, and her feet had been tied together with some braided hemp rope. She was wearing a pair of white patent leather cath go-go boots, and some light green denim pants and bikini-style underwear were wrapped around her left leg, giving off the initial impression that she was sexually assaulted. The victim's lower jaw was missing, and she only had two teeth left in her entire skull, but a search of the area failed to turn up her jawbone or any other evidence. While she wore a silver ring with gold indentation on her right ring finger, she carried no identification. At the time, investigators were unable to determine her exact cause of death, but they estimated that her body had been in the ditch for at least 2 or 3 months. The autopsy report showed that the victim's right elbow was dislocated, suggesting that she put up a struggle before she was killed, and it was also possible that her cervical vertebra was dislocated following her death. Since the victim could not be identified, and no one ever came forward to claim her, she would remain a Jane Doe, and was buried in a grave at Riverview Cemetery in the nearby town of Rock Rapids, under a small marker which simply read, "Unidentified Female." The Lyon County Sheriff at the time was Craig Vinson, who was always haunted by the crime, until well after his retirement. Blythe Blomendahl would be elected Lyon County Sheriff in 2001, and he became very invested in the case, as he hoped to identify the Jane Doe, and did everything in his power to ensure she would not be forgotten. Well, in February of 2006, over 27 years after the victim was originally found, it was announced that an identification had finally been made. The previous month, Jane Doe's fingerprints had been entered into the Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System, a national computerized database which was maintained by the FBI. To everyone's surprise, they wound up matching an old fingerprint card from the Los Angeles Police Department, which belonged to a woman named Wilma June Nissen. She had been arrested for prostitution in 1974, and according to her fingerprint card, one of her known aliases was Boots, which seemed particularly interesting since Jane Doe had been found wearing go-go boots. There didn't seem to be any official missing persons report on file for Wilma, and the only available photograph was the mugshot that was taken following her arrest. Well, less than 24 hours after the news about Wilma June Nissen went public, the Lyon County Sheriff's Office was contacted by Chrissy Haas, a 28-year-old woman from Seal Beach, California, who claimed that Wilma was her biological mother. Since Chrissy was placed in foster care following her birth, she never got the chance to meet her mother, and had spent years trying to find her. Chrissy was assisted in her search by a woman named Starla Patterson, the mother of one of her childhood friends. Starla recognized Wilma's name in the newspaper and informed Chrissy about what was going on, which prompted her to get in touch with investigators. When Chrissy faxed them a photo which had been taken of Wilma when she was 18 years old, it appeared to be an exact match to her mugshot. This provided additional confirmation that Wilma was the Jane Doe, and DNA testing would soon positively identify Chrissy as Wilma's daughter. It turned out that Wilma had originally been born in San Francisco on October the 19th, 1954, making her 23 years old at the time of her death. Wilma's parents were Charles and June Nissen, and in March of 1956, the couple had another daughter named Mary, who died when she was born. A few years later, the Nissens had another daughter named Mona, who was unable to hear or speak, and unfortunately, both she and Wilma would experience an horrific childhood. When Wilma was only 8 years old, her mother abandoned the family, and her father turned out to be a horribly neglectful parent who would not allow Wilma or Mona to attend school and kept them locked in a bedroom closet whenever he left to go to work. After Charles lost his job, he was forced to move his family out of their home, and they lived inside a car. Wilma would have to scour the streets for food, and Mona was often kept confined inside the vehicle's trunk. In 1964, the two girls were finally removed from their father's care by the state, who sent Mona to an institution and placed Wilma in foster care. Wilma's first foster family was a couple named Maxine and Marshall Holt, and even though she was 10 years old by this point, Wilma could not read or write and lacked such basic skills as knowing how to eat with a fork. But when Wilma was able to start attending school for the first time, she proved to be a fast learner who was always enthusiastic about being taught new things. She really started developing as a person, but after raising her for 2 years, the Holts were forced to give up Wilma because Maxine had developed rheumatoid arthritis and could no longer take care of her. Wilma went on to live with two other foster families before she wound up with a couple named Vincent and Alice Haas, who raised her during her teen years. However, on her 18th birthday in 1972, Wilma left their home to go out for a walk and never returned. At some point, she hooked up with a man named Donald Eugene Wellington, and they would get married during the summer of 1973. It was during this time period when Wilma turned to sex work, and she would be arrested no less than 7 times in 2 years, including the arrest in Los Angeles in 1974, which led to the discovery of her fingerprint card. Now, the exact details of what happened are pretty murky, but while she was still married to Donald, Wilma became pregnant with the child of another man named Michael Jean Pizarro. Michael was known for being a transient, and Wilma gave birth to his son, Michael Jr., in San Diego in May of 1974. Rumor has it that Wilma and Michael Sr. were in the midst of hitchhiking to Florida with their newborn baby before Michael Jr. was taken away from them and placed in foster care. Michael Sr. apparently continued to live a transient lifestyle until he was killed in a bicycle accident in Key West in 1989 at the age of 44. Well, believe it or not, shortly after giving birth to Michael Jr., Wilma became pregnant again, only this time with her husband, Donald. The child was born prematurely in December of that year and named Donald Jr. Once again, details are very sketchy, but it sounds like Donald Jr. also wound up in foster care, and Wilma and Donald Sr. officially divorced sometime in 1975. Wilma eventually got hitched with another man named Robert Alexander Irvin and became pregnant again before the couple married in Long Beach in June of 1977. On August the 18th, she gave birth to a daughter named Crystal, who would later be nicknamed Chrissy, but much like with Wilma's previous child, the baby was premature and weighed just over 2 pounds at the time of her birth. Wilma soon ended her relationship with Robert and left the area, and Chrissy was placed in foster care. 3 years later, Chrissy was legally adopted by Vincent and Alice Haas, the same foster family who had raised Wilma before she went out on her own. While she never got to meet her mother, Chrissy did manage to track down her father when she was 17 years old, though Robert would pass away a few years later. It sounds like after she left Long Beach, Wilma moved to San Diego, where she lived in a camper and crossed paths with a 54-year-old man named Charles Inman Belt. The story goes that in February of 1978, another sex worker asked Charles to take Wilma out of California because someone was trying to hurt her, so he drove Wilma to his hometown of Atlanta, Georgia, where they moved in with Charles's mother. According to Charles, Wilma only stayed with them for 2 weeks before she took off, and he always assumed she returned to San Diego. However, for reasons which were not yet clear, Wilma somehow wound up being murdered in Lyon County 5 or 6 months later. Anyway, a new headstone bearing the name Wilma June Nissen, along with the words "Our Girl," would be placed on her grave at Riverview Cemetery, and a memorial service was held on June the 3rd, 2006. It was attended by around 70 people, including Craig Vinson, the retired Lyon County Sheriff who originally worked the case and was 87 years old by this point, Wilma's original foster parents, Maxine and Marshall Holt, who had managed to stay in touch with her until 1976, and Chrissy's longtime friend, Starla Patterson. Chrissy herself was unable to attend, but she finally visited her mother's grave a few months later. As for Wilma's younger sister, Mona, it was confirmed that she was still alive at the age of 47 and had spent the past few decades living in a foster home. It also turned out that their father, Charles, had passed away in 1986, while their mother, June, died in 2003. After performing extensive research into Wilma's life, Lyon County Sheriff Blythe Blomendahl stated, quote, "You just get to a point in time where you think you know them well enough that you can almost describe how they feel on a certain day. You just get to a point where you think you actually know her," end quote. So now that Wilma finally had her identity back, the focus turned to figuring out who killed her. The Lyon County Sheriff's Office attempted to track down Wilma's first husband, Donald Eugene Wellington, though he was not considered to be a suspect in her murder. Donald also lived a transient lifestyle and had a lengthy criminal record, including an arrest for stealing a bicycle in Palmdale, California, in 2005. It's unclear if Donald was ever questioned, but an online search shows that he passed away in March of 2009 at the age of 60. In September of 2007, Wilma's body was exhumed in hopes of extracting potential DNA evidence which might have belonged to her killer. The exhumation took place on a rainy day, and unfortunately, since Wilma's coffin had been buried inside an inexpensive, non-sealing concrete vault, it turned out there were approximately 40 gallons of water inside, which wiped out all hope of recovering DNA from her remains. But there were still pieces of evidence available for DNA testing, such as Wilma's clothing and fingernails, and they would be sent to the FBI laboratory in Quantico, Virginia. They wound up finding DNA which did not belong to Wilma on the rope that had been used to bind her feet. A forensic anthropologist also performed a new examination of Wilma's remains, which finally allowed investigators to determine her cause of death, though this information has never been released publicly. In August of 2009, an 82-year-old man named John Van Gameren was arrested on 6 counts of perjury in connection to this case. Van Gameren lived in the small town of Inwood at a residence which was within a 5-mile radius of the location where Wilma's body was found. Van Gameren had lived in the same residence back in 1978, and he would be questioned by investigators on 2 separate occasions. However, even though he was under oath, Van Gameren apparently lied to them about a number of details, many of which involved him transporting sex workers and strippers across state lines from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, into Lyon County. The charges against Van Gameren would be dismissed in February of 2010, but it turned out that Sioux Falls had great significance to this case. Investigators would eventually learn that in the months prior to her murder, Wilma had worked in Sioux Falls at an escort service, which went under such names as Playgirls or Playmates. In 2014, Chief Deputy Jerry Berkey, the lead detective at the Lyon County Sheriff's Office, told the local media that he had questioned a person who was known to law enforcement in both Sioux Falls and another town in South Dakota called Yankton. This person was supposedly present on the night Wilma was murdered and failed 2 polygraph tests. Even though the DNA which was found on the rope around Wilma's feet did not match this individual, Berkey said this did not clear them because he suspected there was more than one person involved in the crime. Berkey then stated that he was searching for a second person of interest, a light-skinned African-American female who had worked as a sex worker and dancer in the Sioux Falls area and went by the nickname Peaches. In May of 2016, Berkey revealed that one of the prime suspects in this case was an African-American woman who had worked alongside Wilma at the same escort service as a sex worker and dancer and went by the stage name Sugar. Investigators had managed to locate Sugar and interviewed her multiple times, but she denied any involvement in Wilma's murder. During the summer of 1978, Wilma and Sugar were often hired to offer their services at quote-unquote sex parties in Lyon County. A photograph of Sugar which had been taken sometime during the mid-1970s was circulated by the media, but Berkey stated that they were not going to publicly release Sugar's real name until someone came forward to confirm her identity and link her to Wilma. He also provided more information about the other female person of interest, known only as Peaches, who originally hailed from Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. She also worked for the same escort service, and was alleged to have teamed up with Sugar in order to rob people during that time period. Unlike Sugar, police did not have a photograph of Peaches or know her real name or current whereabouts. Shortly after Wilma's murder, Sugar fled to Canada, though after an incident in which she allegedly stabbed someone, she was forced to return to the United States. The theory that investigators have pushed forward is that Wilma was killed at one of the sex parties in Lyon County before her body was dumped in the ditch. They believe that the motive was robbery because someone wanted to steal all the money Wilma had earned at the party. According to Berkey, when the sheriff's office attempted to question local residents about these parties, they would become very defensive and were not particularly helpful. However, Berkey believes there are witnesses out there who saw Wilma and Sugar together and may have potentially important information about what happened. He stated, quote, "They didn't see Wilma get killed at this party. They saw something that led up to her being killed, and they just don't realize what they saw." End quote. A $10,000 reward has been offered for information which leads to an arrest or a conviction, but for the moment, the murder of Wilma June Nissen continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a few moments to talk about our new sponsor, BetterHelp. Sometimes it's easy to ask yourself what interferes with your happiness and prevents you from achieving your goals, which is why a service like BetterHelp can be essential at assessing your needs. BetterHelp will match you with your very own licensed professional therapist, and you will be connected in a safe, private, and convenient online environment. Once you're matched up, you can start communicating in under 48 hours without even having to leave your home or sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. This is very useful, because BetterHelp offers a broad range of expertise which may not be locally available in many areas. They are also committed to ensuring your therapeutic matches work for you, so if you ever wanted to change counselors, it's easy and free. BetterHelp is convenient, professional, and affordable, and anything you share during your sessions is confidential. So start living a happier life today. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/trail. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. That's betterhelp.com/trail for 10% off your first month. Thanks, BetterHelp, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So as I'm sure you're well aware, a lot of John and Jane Doe's who went unidentified for long periods of time have finally got their names back in recent years, thanks to organizations such as the DNA Doe Project. In most of these cases, it turned out the victim never had any official missing persons report on file, which is why it took so long to connect the dots. While their loved ones sometimes did make an attempt to report them missing, it could often be difficult to convince law enforcement to even take a report back in the 1970s or early 1980s. If the victim was an adult, and there was no clear-cut evidence that foul play had taken place, the police would often hold the mentality that these people had the legal right to disappear if they wanted to. And it was usually downright impossible to report someone missing if they led a transient lifestyle and had no fixed address to be missing from. That was definitely the case with Wilma June Nissen, who spent most of her life living in California and wound up being murdered in Iowa, a state which she did not have any known ties to, so you can understand why it took so long to identify her. It's not like Wilma didn't have people in her life who wondered what happened to her, but she just had a tendency to not stay in the same place for very long, so there was no reason to automatically assume she had become a victim of foul play. And let's face it, since Wilma had an arrest record from being involved in sex work and had 3 children with 3 different men who all wound up being placed in foster care, I'm not sure the police would have exerted much effort trying to find her, even if she had been reported missing back then. But thankfully, the investigators in Lyon County who have worked her case over the past 4 decades sound like pretty compassionate people who believe that every victim deserves justice regardless of their background. Unlike most recent cases involving the identification of decedents, Wilma was not initially ID'd through DNA testing, but through a fingerprint match, and it's just incredible luck that someone from Los Angeles decided to enter her arrest record from 1974 into a federal database, making this match possible. In many of these stories involving John and Jane Doe's, there's always a lot of speculation about what kind of lives they had before their deaths, but given that no one ever came forward to claim them, people usually assume the worst. Well, sadly, in the case of Wilma June Nissen, that assumption would be correct. Wilma grew up in a broken home in which she was abandoned by her mother and was horribly neglected by her father, so much so that she was completely lacking in basic life skills until she was placed in foster care at age 10. The story of Wilma's sister Mona is even more heartbreaking, since she was deaf and mute and had to endure such atrocities as being confined inside a car trunk, but at least it sounds like she was relatively well cared for after she was taken away from her father, since she was still alive when Wilma was identified in 2006. While there was a stretch of a few years when Wilma seemed to be doing well, she never made it past the 10th grade, and it seems like once she turned 18 and became a legal adult, she decided to venture out on her own. I appreciated the non-judgmental attitude many of the investigators seemed to have about Wilma's past history with sex work, as they felt she likely went that route because someone in her position would not have had very many options back then. When I first read that Wilma gave birth to 2 children, 7 months apart in 1974, I figured the dates had to be a typo because that sounded biologically impossible. But no, it sounds like she got pregnant almost immediately after she first gave birth, and her 2nd child was born prematurely. What's odd is that both of Wilma's pregnancies took place while she was married to her husband Donald, but the father of her 1st child was a man named Michael Jean Pizarro. Since Michael died a long time ago, It's unclear how he and Wilma became acquainted in the first place, but given the amount of arrests she had on her record during this time period, you have to wonder if Wilma became pregnant accidentally through her sex work. As far as I can tell, the whereabouts of Wilma's two sons, Michael Jr. and Donald Jr., are still unknown to this day, but since they were placed in foster care, they may have been raised under new identities and have zero knowledge of their mother's backstory. It sounds like the main reason Wilma might have taken off after her daughter's birth was because Chrissy was also born prematurely and weighed only 2 pounds, meaning it would have required additional work to take care of her. Due to her tumultuous childhood, Wilma just did not have the coping skills to deal with unexpected obstacles like that, and she likely felt overwhelmed. During interviews with the media, Chrissy has always been open about the fact that she had a pretty difficult life as well, as she was a rebellious teen who split from her foster parents and became a ward of the court at age 15. That same year, she had discovered a photograph of her mother in her foster parents' possessions, but they took it away from her and said they didn't want her to know about Wilma. Chrissy went through an incredibly dark period in which she seemed to be heading down the same path as her mother, but she now at least has answers about what happened to her. However, there won't be complete closure until someone is finally charged with Wilma's murder, which is why Chrissy has recently made a bunch of posts on Reddit about her mother's death, and approached a number of different true crime podcasts, including The Trail Went Cold, to spread awareness of Wilma's story. So from what I've gathered about the investigation, the Lyon County Sheriff's Office seemed to have a pretty good idea about what likely happened to Wilma and who was responsible for killing her, but they lack sufficient evidence to make an arrest. Of course, there are many key details which they are continuing to withhold from the public, and even though Chrissy is the victim's daughter, these details have been kept secret from her as well. It sounds like the police have at least 2 potential suspects, but this particular situation is pretty unique, to say the least. We have one suspect named Sugar, who has been interviewed by investigators, but they've only elected to release an old photograph of her to the public and withheld her name. And we have a second suspect named Peaches, whose real name and current whereabouts are unknown. But before we talk more about the crime itself, we have to backtrack a little bit. It's quite fascinating to do a chronological search through all the news articles about this case and witness the investigators make a gradual attempt to piece together Wilma June Nissen's life once they figured out her identity. While she spent the majority of her life living in California, Wilma wound up traveling to Atlanta with a man named Charles Inman Belt and spent 2 weeks living with him and his mother before she took off. Unlike many of the other men in Wilma's life, Charles was still alive following her identification, so police were able to track him down and interview him. It sounds like Charles was asked to drive Wilma from San Diego to Atlanta because her life had been threatened, but details are pretty murky, and I have no idea if this has any relevance to Wilma's murder. We do know that Wilma left Atlanta in February of 1978 and wound up dead over 1,100 miles away in rural Iowa, and even though her body was discovered in October, she was likely killed sometime in July or August. So we have a gap of around 5 or 6 months in which we know very little about Wilma's movements, though I'm sure investigators have learned many details they have not released publicly. The one key detail which has been revealed is that at some point in 1978, Wilma wound up working for an escort service in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Lyon County is the most northwestern county in all of Iowa and borders the state line, so Sioux Falls is only about 20 to 30 miles from the spot where Wilma was found. The story goes that women from this escort service often traveled to the area in order to service and entertain people at what were described as sex parties, but whenever law enforcement has tried to question local residents about this, they are not exactly overjoyed to be discussing it. Lyon County has been described as one of the most conservative counties in all of Iowa, so I can see why people might be reluctant to talk about such a taboo subject. I know there was a development in the case in 2009, when a local resident named John Van Gameren was charged with 6 counts of perjury for lying to law enforcement about his alleged role in transporting strippers and sex workers to these parties. The charges were dropped a few months later, and since Van Gameren was 82 years old at the time, I have no idea if he's even still alive today, but here are some more specific details about the false statements Van Gameren supposedly made. He lied to police about knowing who arranged for strippers to appear at a bachelor party which was held at his residence sometime in 1978, even though he was the one who actually organized the party. He also denied ever having sex workers at his home, a statement which was proven false. In addition, Van Gameren shared a story about losing his wallet or having it stolen at an airport in Las Vegas, even though another witness had told authorities that the wallet had been stolen by a sex worker. And when shown a photograph of a specific sex worker, Van Gameren denied ever knowing her, which was apparently untrue. I don't get the impression that Van Gameren was ever suspected of potentially being involved in Wilma's murder, but I would not be surprised if he crossed paths with her at some point. The police have never specifically stated this, but since Van Gameren lived within a 5-mile radius of the spot where Wilma's body was discovered, it's possible she attended a party at his residence on the night she was killed. I keep thinking back to this quote from Chief Deputy Jerry Berkey, quote, "They didn't see Wilma get killed at this party. They saw something that led up to her being killed, and they just don't realize what they saw," end quote. Indeed, that might be one of the biggest obstacles in this investigation, as it sounds like police need at least one or two witnesses who will confirm having seen Wilma and Sugar together at one of these sex parties. But these witnesses may be keeping their mouths shut because they don't want to admit to having attended them. Since they withheld a number of details, we can't be certain how much law enforcement does or does not know, but their primary theory seems to be that the motive for Wilma's murder was robbery because someone wanted to steal the money she had earned while working at a party. But if that's what happened, it sounds like the perpetrator or perpetrators wanted to give off the false impression that Wilma was the victim of a sex crime. This would explain why she was found nude from the waist up, and her pants and underwear were wrapped down her left leg, but if the killers were female, which is what investigators seem to be leaning towards, the whole scene was probably staged. While it may have looked like the rope had been tied around Wilma's feet in order to restrain her, it was likely just done because the perpetrator had difficulty carrying Wilma's body to the ditch, and they needed to use the rope to drag her there. I know that Chief Deputy Berkey has stated that Wilma was murdered so violently and in such a specific way that they are withholding details about the exact cause of death because it is something that only the killer would know. While those words are pretty unsettling, when you consider that Wilma's lower jaw and most of her teeth were missing, so I have to wonder what actually happened to her. It's also interesting how Berkey confirmed there was unknown DNA found on the rope, but it did not match an individual they suspected of being the killer. However, because he believes that more than one person was involved in the crime, that individual has not been eliminated as a suspect. Now, when Berkey originally made this statement back in 2014, he had not yet publicly revealed any details about Sugar, so I can't confirm whether or not it was Sugar's DNA he was referring to. But it's worth noting that since law enforcement has never uncovered the identity of the second person of interest known only as Peaches, they're obviously not going to have her DNA on file for comparison. It has been confirmed that both Sugar and Peaches had a history of robbing other sex workers and dancers during this time period, and since they were working at the same escort service as Wilma, it's not hard to imagine the same thing potentially happening to her. I do find it intriguing that Sugar temporarily fled to Canada following Wilma's murder, since Peaches was a Canadian citizen. We know Sugar eventually returned to the US, but if Peaches is still alive, it would not surprise me at all if she's still somewhere in Canada today. The situation with Sugar is something I honestly don't believe I've ever seen before in a cold case investigation. The police definitely know Sugar's identity and have interviewed her, but while they publicly withheld her real name, they were willing to release an old photograph from the 1970s. So I get the impression that investigators are certain that the woman they interviewed is the same young woman from the photo, but given that 4 decades have passed, they still want someone to come forward and conclusively confirm it's Sugar. However, it's been nearly 5 years since this photo was released, and I have not heard about any further developments since then. If Sugar and Peaches are guilty, then it seems like they got incredibly lucky that they happened to murder Wilma in a state which she did not have any connection to, which is why it took over 27 years to even identify her. However, I now wonder if there were residents from Lyon County who might have known who this Jane Doe was all the way back in 1978, but elected not to say anything for fear of implicating themselves in these sex parties. If true, then that's a major tragedy, because if Wilma had been identified a lot earlier, perhaps investigators might have had an easier time building up a murder case against the responsible parties. As it is right now, this sounds like another one of those frustrating situations where police have pretty much solved the case in their own minds, but just lacked that one crucial piece of evidence to make an arrest. Overall, I would definitely rank this as one of the saddest stories ever featured on The Trail Went Cold, because it involved a victim who lived a difficult life from the day she was born before it was taken away from her in horrific fashion. But all it might take to close the books on this story for good would be for the right person to come forward with information. So if you happen to know anything about the murder of Wilma June Nissen or the women known only as Sugar and Peaches, please contact the Lyon County Sheriff's Office at 712-472-8300. That's 712-472-8300. The case number is 78-06487. That's 78-06487. There's also still a $10,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction, and if you want to send in any tips anonymously, their hotline is 712-472-8334. That's 712-472-8334. Anyway, a special thanks to Wilma's daughter, Chrissy Haas Atkinson, for getting in touch with me and working diligently to keep her mother's story alive. Hopefully, she will be able to witness a resolution to this case someday. So if you have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I did something a little different from the norm by releasing an episode about a case which has been solved, the murder-suicide of the Benoit family. You probably know that I'm a lifelong professional wrestling fan, and Chris Benoit's decision to murder his wife Nancy and 7-year-old son Daniel before taking his own life has always haunted me, so I decided to put together an episode in which I detailed this horrible crime and shared my personal thoughts on it. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Kaja K, Cheryl C, Kareen R, Amy R, Kate W, Lisa MW, and Brent A. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I would like to play a promo for another podcast called Crimes of the Centuries. Have a listen.
Sometimes a case comes along that is so heinous, so shocking, that it's called the crime of the century. Truth is, though, there have been a lot of those cases over the years. I'm Amber Hunt, an award-winning journalist and author, with a new podcast that marries true crime with history. It's called Crimes of the Centuries from the Obsessed Network. I'm examining stories that left a mark. Some of them are first of their kind, like the country's first recorded murder trial or first kidnapping for ransom. Crimes of the Centuries will explore not just the crimes that were committed, but what was happening in the world at that time and what effects they had on society that we may still notice today. Subscribe to Crimes of the Centuries from the Obsessed Network on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your shows.
I'd also like to announce that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The regular CrimeCon, which takes place at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas, from June 4th until the 6th, and the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London. I had previously stated that CrimeCon UK was set to take place on the weekend of June 12th and the 13th, but due to certain restrictions, they have now elected to postpone it until the weekend of September the 25th and 26th, so fingers crossed that it will still happen as planned. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.